Blog Talk Radio.
Turmoil fans, welcome to the show here on another Sunday. Happy Grandparents Day to all the grandparents that may or may not be listening today. If you're looking for some wrestling today, KDW happening today in Jeffersonville, Indiana. You also have WCWC happening in Salem, Oregon, and NWA Blue Collar Wrestling like usual in Portland at the North Portland Eagles. Today on our show, we are paying tribute to one of the all-time great promotions, one of the largest wrestling promotions in the world during its time. We're speaking, of course, of World Championship Wrestling, WCW. WCW is what happened when Ted Turner and his company bought Jim Crockett Promotions and took over. They formed WCW. They were in business from late 1988 until spring of 01. And I would like to bring someone on right now that knows quite a bit of WCW. He is a former WCW Tag Team Champion co-holder. He was the booker there. He wrestled for the company. Kevin Sullivan, welcome back to Turnbuckle Turmoil. Thanks for being here as we pay tribute to WCW.
Thank you, Sign Guy. I appreciate it.
Well, for the people that are looking for a little background, I know you were with WCW a few different times. Could you tell us what led you to initially joining World Championship Wrestling?
Well, I was there when it was bought from Crockett. Turner bought it. And I was there when Crockett bailed out of the wrestling business. And it was a unique thing that Ted Turner stepped in and bought the wrestling business. And then he put us all under contracts. That was the first time I believe that contracts were started.
I believe you're right. It was very rare that there were contracts in wrestling up until that point. It was more of a handshake promise more than anything. Am I right?
Yeah, there was a few guys that had contracts with Crockett, but only a handful. And I think there was contracts back in the 50s to some guys. But other than that, this was a brand new day.
Like I said, you were there in a few different stints. You left WCW for a while, and then came back and you immediately started feuding against the Nasty Boys with your brother Dave.
Yeah.
A lot happened in the meantime. They went from being ran by Executive Vice President Jim Herd to briefly ran by a guy named Kip Fry to
right.
The Bill Watts era to Eric Bischoff. When you came back, what were some of the main differences you noted that were different from when you first had left WCW to when you came back? How were things ran differently at that point?
Well, they were starting to listen to wrestling people. You know, Jim Herd was a blight upon the wrestling business. He knew nothing of it. You know, we had RoboCop, we had the Ding Dongs, we had all cartoon characters. He was trying to get the kids involved in wrestling, and he lost his way. Because back in the day, WCW was an NWA member, and we were one of the last holdouts of NWA. And NWA was perceived more of a sport than a spectacle.
You referenced RoboCop. In WCW's history, they used a lot of celebrities, everyone from RoboCop, like you mentioned, to Mr. T, whom you had actually wrestled at Starrcade, to Kiss, to Dennis Rodman and Karl Malone getting in the ring. There's a lot of use of celebrities. When you look back at things, do you think that the people running WCW, by and large, knew how to properly use celebrities to draw an audience that was going to stick with WCW?
You know, I think they did a pretty fair job because they picked guys that were big-time athletes. Like Karl Malone was a great athlete, and he fit in very good. Kevin Green was a superb athlete and NFL sack leader at one time. And Kevin performed way above what I thought he would perform. So, yeah, I think they did a pretty good job at putting the celebrities in.
For the younger listeners that might be listening and don't totally comprehend just how big WCW was, in the mid-90s when you had the Nitro era and the Monday Night Wars going, WCW was the number one wrestling promotion in the world. You could go to any mall across the country and find WCW t-shirts, action figures. They had their own magazine. They were all over mainstream television doing guest appearances on network shows, the late night talk shows, everything that was popular. WCW tied into that. You were a part of that in a major way. What was it like working for a company that was so big at that point?
It was a really big deal, as you mentioned, on. It was a phenomenon. People were having Nitro parties, and everything was also, like you said, everybody had a t-shirt of Sting, Goldberg, Hogan, NWO. It was huge. Sign Guy, can you continue and let me call you right back in? I got to plug this phone in.
Absolutely.
Okay.
All right. Well, Kevin will be right back now. QT, mid-90s WCW, for the listeners that aren't really aware or appreciative, they would do monster TV ratings, the likes of which never have been seen again. They were doing record numbers on a weekly basis. They kept growing and growing the ratings. They would regularly do in the sixes and sevens on TNT and TBS during the week. Those kind of numbers, unparalleled. They achieved huge success. Now, QT, I know that WCW had a lot of great, great talent, but do you think, let's bring Kevin right back on. So, Mr. Solomon, I was talking about the ratings and how the ratings at that time were unparalleled. You would break rating records on a weekly basis, it seemed like. When you look back at those types of numbers, do you think anyone will ever again approach the types of numbers that WCW was doing on television?
I think it's a different animal now, Sign Guy, where the viewing audience has so much more and they don't have to watch things on TV, streaming. You know, this was probably the last time that people as a group of this country watched shows together. What I'm saying is that was still a thing. They used to call it water cooler talk, where people would go get in an office, would be getting a glass of water, and they'd say, "Hey, did you see the wrestling show last night? Which one?" "Oh, I watched both of them." So it became exceptionally well produced. It was on a major cable systems around the country, so it was probably in at least 90% of the homes, and it was the hottest thing on cable. I mean, we beat the NBA in the finals, the NBA finals, year after year. It was a phenomenon, and I hate to think that it won't be broken, but I think times are changing and ratings are different now, and it's harder to get those kind of ratings because of all the technology that you're challenged for. So,
all right. Well, Mr. Kevin Sullivan, we are joined by someone else that has some
WCW
experience. Yes, it is. I'd like to introduce another WCW Tag Team Champion co-holder, Crowbar. Welcome to the show.
Hey, what's going on, guys?
Hey, Chris, how are you?
Me and Kevin just spoke this morning. This is great.
Yeah.
How's it going?
Well, going very well. Well, Crowbar, for the fans that may not be familiar with your journey to WCW, could you tell us how you came to be in that company?
It actually happened in phases, and actually Kevin Sullivan was very instrumental in getting me down there. I was working on the independent circuit on the Northeast for a few years, and I was working quite often for Tony Rumble in Boston, who Kevin also worked for, and it was through working for Tony that I actually went down to WCW for the first time as Devin Storm, and I did a lot of the cruiserweight stuff. And that was my first time down there. Then that was nightly. I was still full-time in school, going to college, going to physical therapy school. I would come in and out on a nightly basis. I did some cruiserweight stuff. I did some tag team stuff with Ace Darling on the independent circuit up here. We did a tag team down there called the Extreme. And then I graduated physical therapy school, worked for about a year full time, and then I was brought down as a full timer.
Yeah, and Chris was very, very good at, and I was the world heavyweight champion for Tony Rumble. I beat Jimmy Snuka. And here's what's funny. You could never get away with that. And today, it would be all over the sheets and all over the internet. Nobody knew it at WCW.
Yeah.
And that's what was crazy. And Tony ran a great independent promotion. And a lot of his talent, Taz, Tommy Dreamer, Crowbar, a lot of those guys became big stars. So Tony's was very instrumental, and this isn't today how the independent scene is instrumental in sending guys to the WWE.
Absolutely. Now, Crowbar, like we mentioned, both you and Kevin separately, of course, held the WCW tag team titles. You teamed up with David Flair to have yours. You had a pretty good run teaming with David Flair and Daphne. What was it like working with David Flair, who was still really new to the business but had the pedigree that they were pushing?
Well, it was actually him being new and inexperienced actually opened the door for me. When I was signed to the full-time deal, I was told to go down to the power plant, and it was my understanding that I was going to be used primarily as a cruiserweight guy. And I had gone from the power plant to the Saturday night show doing cruiserweight stuff. Devin Storm, and I was working guys like Billy Kidman, Jamie Noble, Mike Sanders, Vampiro doing more of that cruiserweight style thing. With the story, as far as I know, as far as what was told to me, was they had TV in Denver, Colorado. It was the same time when there was also the Saturday Night Show nearby. I walked into a bar. I had my hair down really, really long, and Russo, for whatever reason, took a liking to me. At that time, David Flair, not very good. He was green and just not very athletic at all. But Kevin, correct me if I'm wrong. At that time, for whatever reason, he was popping a rating, I guess, because he was doing the crazy guy stalking Kimberly, and he was whacking people with the crowbar and all that. But when it came to having to put him in a ring, there wasn't much that David could do. So they came up with the idea, let's get David with a tag partner. We'll let the partner do the majority of the wrestling, and we could still get this gimmick over. So it was kind of his inability to wrestle, which actually opened the door for me from just being a nameless cruiserweight guy to actually having a character.
Sign guy.
Yes, sir.
You should talk about, did you ever see the bumps Crowbot took off from the scaffolds with, God bless him, the Wall?
Yes, I remember that.
Wow. There was one that was incredible.
A lot of people talk about the scaffold one from Bash at the Beachhead. I think it was. I think I'm not sure which was right off the side of the with the big screen there, right off the side of that scaffold. But actually,
yeah.
in my opinion, the more dangerous, the more impressive one was one a few weeks earlier where he got me around the neck on the outside of the apron, and we both jumped simultaneously from the ring apron through the announce table, you know, and that's a good 6-7 feet. And he was just so big and strong, he was able to put me right in the middle of that table there. And, you know, the one off the side of the big screen, although it was really nice, it was just a straight drop. This one off the side of the ring, we both had to go down, up, and travel out 7 feet.
Yeah.
And hit the middle of that table. I watch it now, and I say, what the hell was I thinking? there was so much that could go wrong there, but it made for a really cool moment, though.
Yeah. You know, we went through a bad time in that era where we lost a lot of young guys. And Jerry would have been a big name today, don't you think, Chris?
Absolutely. He looked great. He was athletic, and he was just an all-around great guy. You never met one person that didn't like him.
Yeah.
And he was all about getting the whole show over. Like, he wasn't a selfish wrestler. He looked great.
Yeah.
He had so much potential to be a star.
Yeah. And you guys had some of the best matches. So, Sign Guy, if you run into your fans, and you yourself should look back at some of their matches, and not just that spot that they did going through off scaffolds. I mean, it was an incredible matchups with Chris and the Wall, because they just seemed to click. Chris, you guys had known each other, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Since day one. We both started off at Mike Sharp's school. My first match ever was a battle royal that he was in. And then one of my first singles matches ever was against him. So us getting to do that at that level for a major company was very special for the both of us. It was really cool. We had a good chemistry, and even to this day, one of my favorite stories to tell in the ring is with the big guy versus the little guy, whether the little guy's the heel or face. I like doing both, and like, I like taking a bump, but I like flying and actually trying to tell the story of how the smaller guy is able to get the guy with the bigger guy off his feet. It takes creativity and it takes passion, and it's just one of my favorite stories to tell.
Yeah, and I
Mr. Sullivan, Crowbar referenced, of course, the cruiserweights, and he came in originally to do that. The cruiserweight division that WCW had in the mid-90s really set it apart and made it different than pretty much any other promotion. Going back to when WCW was still fairly new, they had a light heavyweight division that didn't really seem to catch on, but once they hit calling it the cruiserweight division and using guys that were legitimate cruiserweight size, it really made a difference. What was the thought process like for the people in the office at WCW putting together a cruiserweight division?
Well, that was my name, cruiserweight, because I took it from boxing. Because Evander Holyfield, before he became the heavyweight champion, became the cruiserweight champion. And I never liked back in the day, Chris, do you remember junior heavyweight champions?
Yeah, yes, it doesn't sound
good. I didn't like that stigma, junior.
Yeah.
And I got rid of the junior heavyweights. And then I also did, when I put the cruiserweight on Eddie Guerrero, I made him the United States heavyweight champion, which was our second belt, while he was still the cruiserweight, showing that the cruiserweights could move up and be successful wrestling big guys. But I brought in some of the best cruiserweights in the world. You've got to realize, there's not too many better than Rey Mysterio, you know what I mean? And Rey was brand new. He was a kid. People hadn't seen anything like that. Then we had Luchador Cruiserweights. Then I had Chris, who had evolved from Cruiserweights, wrestling Jerry, you know, the Wall. So the Cruiserweights weren't just stuck in the Cruiserweight division. So I could manipulate them up and down. Now, I don't think I could do that because the cruiserweights now, except for Ray, are so much smaller. But now the toothpaste is out of the tube. I don't think it matters today because these guys today, put some of the matches they have are incredible.
Crowbar, like you referenced, you were brought in for that cruiserweight division, but you evolved into the tag team division, and you also had a pretty good run, like we were talking about, as a singles heavyweight division wrestler. Did you have a preference as far as which division you were in, or did it matter to you at that point?
Even to this day, I'm a 43 years old. I'm still doing the indies. I love doing cruiserweight-esque matches. The roles have kind of shifted just the way the business has changed. Like way back when, I was one of the smaller guys out there. I go to the independent shows now. I'm one of the larger guys there. So, you know, you turn the clock back.
Hey, Chris, can I interrupt you for a minute?
Sure.
You made a good point that you now are one of the largest guys. And Sign Guy, I want your opinion on this too. It's funny, I was just thinking about this before the phone call. Do you think the business has lost something by not having some big-time heavyweights?
Well, other this right now, and I'll be on PC because I just don't care. Like these days, I call it the way I see it. Maybe I'm old fashioned. Maybe I'm old. In this, the way wrestling is now, the independent circuit in particular, you have a lot of guys running shows that are also wrestlers. And they're wrestlers that were fans not too long ago. A lot of these guys were fans of that cruiserweight style. And thus, they tend to book an entire show of cruiserweight matches. There are big guys out there that are in shape that could go. There's a handful of really big guys that are great workers. But because there's a bias against these bigger guys, you're not going to see them on shows. And it's not right, wrong, or indifferent, but the people booking and the people running the shows, that's the style that they like. Unfortunately, in my opinion, once again, maybe I'm old, maybe I'm out of touch. I always discuss, I think one of the best times in wrestling was WCW, if I had to guess, 94 to 96, 97. I'm not sure the exact time frame, but it was a time when you had your cruiserweights. You
when
had
I was
your
booking
middle of the car.
Let's say.
What happened?
I was kidding.
Yes. But, yes. But you had your cruiserweights. You had your good, strong middle card. You had the larger cruiserweights like a Jericho or a Eddie. You had top name guys like you had Hulk. You had Savage. You had bigger guys like Paige that were coming up, but he was a bigger guy. It really was the circus. If you wanted the cruiserweights, but they weren't on, you knew they were coming up. If you're waiting to see a big name guy, you know they're coming. You're going to see there was something for everybody. But I think in this day and age, a lot of the guys are wrestling, a lot of the guys are smaller. They grew up fans of that cruiserweight style. That cruiserweight style proved to them as a fan that in spite of their size, they could still be wrestlers, so you have a gross number, a huge number of smaller guys that are incredible athletes, incredible talent, but they're running shows, and as a result of that, this is just my opinion, they kind of keep the larger guys off. And when you have an entire show of cruiserweight matches, they mean less. If you had an 8-match card and you had a tag match, you had your heavyweight match, but you had maybe one or two cruiserweight matches, maybe a crazy lucha libre match in there, you're going to remember those matches more, and they're going to mean more. I think Ring of Honor is great, has incredible athletes. They have a niche, but it's an entire show of cruiserweight-esque style wrestling. And when you have an entire show that style, nothing special. Once again, my opinion, maybe I'm totally wrong, but there's still fans out there that are parents bringing their kids, smaller kids, pre-high school kids, and you want a few guys out there larger than life. If the guy sucks,
yeah,
you don't want him out there, but there's plenty of bigger guys out there that can work, that have bodies, and if you have a casual fan, not a hardcore fan, but if you have a casual fan at ringside and they're watching this guy, and he walks out, and he's 6'5", 6'7", wow. That's an attraction, and they're going to come back to see that. Is he going to go out there and have a 5-star Japanese-style match? No, but not every match needs to be that. And I guess I just vented. I probably pissed off a whole bunch of people, but I really don't care. So that's my opinion.
and I think you're right, Chris, and I think that these guys that are running wrestling that were wrestling fans do not want big guys overshadowing them. And I'll give you an example.
Can I stop you for
one
second? I'm not even sure if they don't want them overshadowing them, but if they're running the shows, they're running a show entirely of the style that they like, which from a business standpoint, is not going to get you all the fans in the building. You got to cater to people that want to see everything. You know, so I don't even know if it's malicious, but it's bad business. They just don't know better. It's what you personally like may not be good for the product as a whole, and you need to mix it up.
Okay, I want to ask you a question, both of you guys, okay? And sure. I have this, and maybe I'm old too, Chris, and I'm out of touch, but people say to me, this guy's fabulous, this guy's over, right? And we're talking about maybe somebody from Ring of Honor, and they got 400 people in the audience. Is that over in today's day and age? 400 people? And where I'm going with this guy can do everything, right? We'll say a guy can do everything, but he's only drawing 400 people. The Rock, when he does work, when he raises the eyebrow, the show's over, right? And
yeah.
He's over because this is maybe, I think the business has lost something with people not dressing in wrestling boots. I'm not saying you have to have tights, but maybe the shorts like Brock wears, but wrestling tights is what The Rock wears. And I know The Undertaker now is wearing his shirt, but he's at the end days. I want to ask both of you guys this question. Name me somebody that drew a lot of money that covered his body up besides Mick Foley.
You really
sign guy? Sign guy?
Nobody really until the 90s really did that.
Who in the 90s drew money for the clothes?
I'd say to a point some of the ECW guys did when they started doing the T-shirts and the pants and everything, but on a much lesser basis, of course.
I'm going to disagree with you and see if you agree with me, Chris. ECW didn't draw a dime once it left Philadelphia. You were on some of those cards, right, Chris?
I was there right when they were starting the with the pay-per-view thing. It was about a year-long since. So I knew of it. I really wasn't that involved. I was
okay,
the bottom of the card guy maximum, you know.
Did they draw money outside of Philadelphia?
When I was there, it was mainly Pennsylvania and about as far north as Boston. At that time, very convenient for me because I went to school in New Jersey and it really didn't go that far. So I really never got to see outside of the tri-state area.
Let me ask you in Sign Guy also. I always thought that ECW was like the Rocky Horror Picture Show. It was audience participation. The audience was part of the show, too. And that's why they never, I mean, when they came to Florida, they didn't draw.
Can I spin this onto something else of what we said before?
Yeah.
Like, talking about the smaller guys, and I watch a network. I do my cardio every morning, an hour and a half, and I watch a network. When you watch the NXT show, it's very similar. They have the same audience, it looks like. They're very into the product. They're passionate about the product. They're super into their characters. And one of the examples is Nakamura, who I believe he was over like crazy there, but I really don't see that he's really gotten over with the mainstream WWE audience. There they went apeshit for him, and they were into his stuff because it was that captive, you know, their version of a hardcore audience at NXT, but that really didn't translate into the larger WWE audience. And I'd say the same thing about the 205 Live guys. When you watched that tournament last year, that audience was supercharged and into all the action. When they tape it in front of that live crowd for SmackDown or Raw, whatever they do it in front of, the reaction is very much different, and they're nowhere near as passionate about those characters as the NXT the Florida audience was. So I think that kind of translates. Like, I mean, what we were saying before, I kind of lost my mindset, but you know, somebody help me.
No, hey, I know what you're saying, and I agree with you. I just saw something And I equated a lot of things to baseball. Baseball has done a survey because of the internet where they're blasting different guys and, you know, get rid of this guy or this guy's better. You know what I mean? Bring this young kid up from the a single A ball. He's tearing it up. You know what I mean? They found out that only 4% of their paying audience spends time, an inordinate amount of time, on the social media. Most people don't have time to spend an hour and a half a day talking about wrestling. They got their lives. And I think that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a very vocal minority who can actually dictate what companies do today. And like this thing about, on my podcast, guys, I had a big thing with him. He's saying, well, they got to turn Roman Reigns heel, right?
Well,
and I
think that's a huge thing there, too. Everybody shits on the guy, part of my language, but the guy's a big guy. He's an incredible athlete. He has great tools, but that very small vocal audience decides they're not going to pop for him. And, you know, like, he's still selling a ton of merch to little kids like him, and it's, I think he gets a really bum rap.
And he's going to be the next big star, action star, in the movies. He will do a movie with The Rock, and as The Rock gets older and gets into producing and directing, that this kid will be the next Rock. But here's the thing. I wonder if they boo him because he's a handsome guy. He's part Italian, part Samoan. What a mixture of genetic status. And I said to him, he says, well, the people who boo him out of the building, they need to turn him heel. And I said, well, isn't he a heel if they're booing him? Isn't he a heel if they're booing him? I mean, and the bottom line is, to me, it doesn't matter if they're booing him or cheering him. They're still drawing with him, aren't they? Or is it me? Sign guy, are they still drawing with Roman Reigns?
Depending on who he's with, I think. Like when he's wrestling with Cena or Brock, I think it draws. But when they put him
I apologize, guys. I got to head out. I got to pick up the with the little ones here, okay? Thanks
so
much for having me.
All right.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Go ahead.
All right. Well,
so do you...
Well, I think when he's in there with a guy like a Cena or a Brock or an Undertaker, he draws, but
yeah.
I think it's similar to like WCW when Hogan was new. He got booed a lot more often than he had, and it just wasn't working quite the same. He had to be in there with the right person to get the reaction they wanted.
Yeah, but the thing was, also, there was a change. The heels started to be... You got to remember, when NWO, if you go back and look at those tapes, they were cheered. The crowd was split. I remember there was we had a big fight in the audience in Toledo, Ohio, where somebody had an NWO flag and another group had a WCW flag, and they had a street fight in the audience, and the cops had to go in and separate. So it was a different thing. But here's the thing. Nope, there's nobody that can say, well, turn to page 52 and this is how we fix it. So I agree with you in some respects, but I think guys got to start looking the part. I don't think you can be wearing all these clothes and go in. And, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's the new thing. But let me ask you this. When guys fight in MMA, we're supposed to be simulating fighting, aren't we? The wrestling?
Right.
When guys go in an MMA, do they wear shirts and stuff? Wouldn't a guy,
nope,
if he was in MMA, grab the guy's shirt, pull it over his head and blind him?
You would think so.
So that's where I'm seeing, what I'm seeing is from the time the guy leaves the dressing room, he's put himself in the hole by not looking like an athlete. And I don't know if that works for you, but there's what I said.
That does make sense. Well, my co-host QT's with us, and QT, did you have any questions also?
Yes, I did. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, QT.
Kevin, were you living in Key West, Florida at the start of your WCW career?
I lived in Isla Mirada, which is in the Keys, yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought you lived a little bit further south to south in Key West.
No, no.
Oh, okay. All right.
I lived 88 miles from Key West, same distance from Cuba.
Oh, okay. All right. So you were pretty much in the middle Keys, not the lower Keys.
Yeah, I was in the middle Keys, yeah.
Oh, all right. Okay. Now, before you began your WCW career or working for them, had you often visited Key West?
I lived there before I worked for them. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Did you ever take collect phone calls from Ted Turner at a payphone from Sloppy Joe's restaurant or the Hog's Breath Saloon?
No, I never did. No, I didn't.
Oh, okay.
I used to go to the mall, Sloppy Joe's, yep.
Oh,
and the Hog's Breath is the original Sloppy Joe's.
Yes, it is. Yes.
Yeah. How do you know so much about Key West?
I was stationed there twice.
Oh, really?
Yes. I was stationed in the Coast Guard there.
I knew Captain Tony, the mayor, the longtime mayor. Him and I were very good friends. Very good friends. Yeah. He was the mayor for about 20 years, yeah. Yeah, I was down there when they broke away from the United States.
Oh, yes, they declared their independence.
Yeah.
Oh. Now, did you ever have a rum and coke with Captain Tony at that famous restaurant, Turtle Crawls?
I had more than rum and coke with Captain Tony on too many occasions.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Now, what was the year you first visited Key West? Can you give us your earliest visit? What year was that?
Yeah, 1973, when there wasn't any. There was like about 12 police the whole 126 miles. It was wide open. Yeah.
My gosh.
It was a good place. You could pull over and get a boiled lobster and a pitcher of beer for $5 in all these little huts. Yeah, there wasn't much there then, except when you got to Key West.
Yes, it really exploded. It really exploded there in the 80s. Yes. Wow.
Yep.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Well, Kevin.
Thank you, guys. I got to bail out myself. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it, and I'm sure I'll see you sooner than later.
That's it. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. QT, WCW, of course, one of the all-time great promotions. They had tons of great matches. Everybody from Ric Flair to Hulk Hogan to Roddy Piper to Vader to Cactus Jack to Dean Malenko to Rey Mysterio to Chris Jericho all performed for WCW, all of the greats. QT, do you yourself have a favorite WCW match of all time?
Well, not necessarily a match, although I am going to research the Sting versus Lex Luger versus, let me see, who was that? Ric Flair. They had a triangular match for the and the winner was going to challenge Randy the Macho Man Savage for the WCW World Heavyweight Championship. I've got to find that match. Yes.
I remember that match. That was at a Starrcade 95.
Yes. Who won that match?
Ric Flair won that match, and then he went on to challenge a Macho Man.
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, don't tell me who the winner was, because I've got to do my research. Yes.
Fair enough, fair enough. Now, QT, over the years, WCW had a lot of great programming. Of course, they were very famous when they first went into Ted Turner's company. Of course, they already had the established time slot of 6:05 Eastern for WCW Saturday night. As soon as they were purchased by Ted Turner, it continued seamlessly from when it was Jim Crockett Promotions. Saturday night was a staple. In 1989, they created WCW Power Hour, which originally aired Friday nights at 10 o'clock, and then they switched a few months into Power Hour's run to Saturday mornings. I believe it was around 9:05 in the morning that Power Hour would air. And they had WCW Main Event on Sunday afternoons, WCW Pro, and WCW Worldwide, which had been a Jim Crockett show as well, aired in syndication. You also had, starting in September of 1995, of course, their most famous show, arguably, WCW Nitro, where the ratings war really went into effect. In 1998, they came out with WCW Thunder on TBS. And, of course, on the Prime Sports Network, which is now defunct, they had a show called WCW Prime, which was hosted by Chris Cruz and Dusty Rhodes and featured not just a main event match, but Dusty Rhodes would refer to it as the moo match of the week, where he would moo like a cow before they showed that. Lots of great programming, QT, over the years. So many countless hours, which all now, of course, are owned by WWE since they purchased the company. But QT, with all those hours, do you have any favorite standout moments from WCW?
Well, I saw that video, WCW Prime, and it was dated Christmas 95, and there was very good interaction with the announcers, Dusty Rhodes, and I didn't quite get the other guy's name, but he had antlers on his head. That was a standout video, Christmas of 95.
I believe that was Chris Cruz as the other announcer.
Oh, okay. All right. And you know, Sunday, at that time, they were still, they had, what struck me on that video was they were still having commercials where you could order things and get VHS tapes. VHS tapes.
I believe WCW had VHS tapes all through their run. When they were sold to WWE, VHS still on the tail end of their popularity. They were about to be phased out, but still accessible at that point.
Yes. Now, Sunday, when in the early 90s, Miami Vice was very popular on TV. Do you think that the WCW, the ratings went head-to-head with Miami Vice?
I believe Miami Vice ended a little bit before Turner bought WCW, but in its day, Nitro and Thunder were doing ratings that equaled anything. They were breaking countless records. And I believe we have someone else on the line. Do we have the other caller with us?
Hey, what's up, y'all? How you doing?
Hey, D, how's it going?
Going good. I'm on assignment. It's an assignment right now, but I had to take at least time to call in within the last 10 minutes of the show. just wanted to throw, say my favorite time about DC to WCW was the pay-per-view events. How, I mean, they rolled with the times. They had their pay-per-view events during main events like Spring Break, Sturgis. I mean, I was driving through South Dakota, and as I'm driving through South Dakota, it was during Sturgis, and I was thinking, wow. I mean, just a few short years ago, say years ago, it had been a big pay-per-view with all these motorcycles just revving it up and everybody going nuts and wild. So that's my memories of WCW during the 90s was the pay-per-view events at certain things, like at Spring Break when they got the pool next to the ring looking like a moat. And there's times when you see NWO coming out and the crowd just going nuts and all these college kids and stuff. I mean, at that time, like he said, it was that thing, the water coolers talk and everybody, and the WCW parties they used to have. Everybody around the nation, you can't see that now. There's no such thing as whatever, say, a promotion and a party on a Monday night.
Absolutely, yeah. Right. And how different was the Hog Wild pay-per-views? You're watching an outdoor show with motorcyclists surrounding the ring, revving their engines in place of applause.
Man, like I said, I mean, just watch it. I mean, I wish it was still going on so that eventually I could have had a reason to purchase a motorcycle just to be part of the crowd. But watching a pay-per-view event like that, I mean, it was just wild to see that because it showed a whole spectrum of a different crowd that was just there to enjoy, you know, they were enjoying a wild week of motorcycle partying, and then you got that day when you got professional wrestling and you had them bigger than life guys walking down the ring. So, you know, the big tough guy image was definitely portrayed back then for that time.
Absolutely. Now, I remember when the Giant debuted, he of course now the Big Show, but when he first debuted, it was at the Great American Bash 95, which I happened to be in attendance for. It was in Dayton, Ohio, at the Hera Arena. And he was sat in the crowd, and they just featured the Giant talking about how big he was. He wasn't named at that point even. He was just the guy in the crowd that they were showing on camera. And that's how they debuted him, this giant guy that nobody knew just sitting in a crowd. They had a lot of great debuts for guys. I don't know if you remember QT or Dimitri, but when Raven made his WCW debut, it was an absolutely huge deal. The internet was losing its mind as they had gotten closer to the date where he was going to debut. It was June 30th of 97, I remember. And on that same exact show, Kurt Hennig made his debut for WCW. And it was just this huge thing on the internet of how great Nitro was going to be. And it was weeks out from that day just because people knew that both Raven was going to be there as well as a couple of surprises. One of them, of course, ending up being Kurt Hennig. You don't get things like that too much anymore.
No, because also at the same aspect, now the internet kind of ruins that.
Exactly. Guys tend to know who's going to be where on any given date, weeks out.
Because me personally, I don't go on my computer on Mondays and Tuesdays and Fridays because I don't want to accidentally look into a news feed and see something that I didn't want to see. That's just me personally.
Exactly.
I feel like the fan aspect of being surprised by things when I want to see. I don't want to know back in my mind, oh, this is what's going to happen. So I avoid that kind of stuff.
WCW, when it was going really strongly, people tend to forget that just a few years prior, they were sort of struggling, but they still had a lot of groundbreaking things. They had the U.S. tag team titles in addition to the WCW tag team titles. You don't see promotions with two separate tag team titles anymore. They had the six-man World Tag Team Championship at WCW. They had the Battle Bowl ring where teams would be made out of the random draw, and then the winning team got entered into a battle royal at the end of the night, and the winner of that would get the Battle Bowl ring. They had the first ever African American World Heavyweight Champion in Ron Simmons. There's just so many innovative things coming out of WCW that today the fans may not appreciate how innovative WCW was in a lot of ways, especially early on in its existence. Dee, what do you think's one innovation that WCW had that might have been its most important contribution?
Wrestling events at malls.
There you go. You just
did
not see that.
I mean, could you imagine if somebody, if they did like that? I'm talking about big scale promotion. Did a wrestling event in the mall now like that? There'd be no way they could. Or, I mean, they'll have to have so much extra security and stuff like that because fans now feel like they want to be part of the show and jump in. I mean, it wouldn't be organized, but back then, I mean, a lot of fans understood what it was. Let's come here and enjoy ourselves.
Absolutely.
Those events that WCW had at the malls was crazy.
Yes, Mall of America, for the listeners not familiar with what Dimitri is mentioning, the very first ever Nitro was held at the Mall of America. They had a big crowd there, and Lex Luger made a shocking debut. He had wrestled for the WWF the day previous to that. They had no idea he was jumping ship. It was a huge shock at the time.
Wow.
Now, QT, same question for you. What do you think was WCW's most innovative contribution to wrestling?
I think when they had those bashes at the beach where a wrestler would fall into the pool in front of a whole bunch of co-eds. Yes.
I believe that was actually the spring breakout. I know what you mean, though. The spring breakout, they would hold those usually like somewhere like Panama City or Padre Island in Texas. And the ring was built on a platform that was above the swimming pool. And usually once a year, someone got knocked into the pool. I remember Kevin Sullivan throwing Hard Body Harrison into the pool one time.
Well, those bashes at the beaches were responsible for thousands of students plunging GPAs. Grade point averages.
Yep. I remember, I believe it was the first. I take it back. I don't believe it was the first ever bash at the beach, but one of the early ones, literally on a beach in Huntington, California. They had it right there on the beach. Dennis Rodman had a part in that. He was just Hulk Hogan's corner man at that point.
Wow. Holy smokes.
Hey, now, Sign Guy, I was going to ask Kevin Sullivan, since we kind of made a connection there with Key West, since we were both there, I was going to ask him if I could set up an SCW type, how would you say, production of Fuji Fights. And Dimitri, I'm going to take this opportunity to ask you if I can get this started with Kevin Sullivan. A Fuji Vice, Squamish Championship Wrestling, whatever, if you would play the part of Don Malato.
Of course, I'd be honored. Thanks, sir.
Oh, okay. All right. And would you like to know who your partner would be in Mr. Fuji?
Who would be my Mr. Fuji?
It would be either Darth Carter or Diafola Dabashi.
That would be a wild pairing indeed.
Wow, either one of you.
Oh, okay.
One of the forgotten things about WCW to a lot of fans is they also had their own Hall of Fame around the time that Vince McMahon started his Hall of Fame. WCW held an annual pay-per-view called Slamboree, and they would induct several people into its Hall of Fame, people like Mr. Wrestling 2, Dusty Rhodes, Gordon Solie, Charlie Ray, all part of the WCW Hall of Fame. And, of course, at Slamboree, they would often feature matches with some of the legends, people like Nick Bockwinkle, Dory Funk Jr., Bob Armstrong, guys that did not wrestle very often at all and did not wrestle for WCW, would come in once a year, and they would do a few matches on the card. Very, very unique circumstances whenever they would do that. Dimitri, looking back at the landscape of things, do you think something like that would work today if WWE or a Ring of Honor or a Global Force Wrestling would try that today?
Oh, yes, it would work and it would succeed. I mean, the shock and anticipation, I would just, like I said, keep it a surprise wrapped up unless it's that one of the people that you're inducting, of course. If one of the inductees, then assume and expect, hopefully, if they are able to wrestle, otherwise have a few names surprised. So when the ring announcer announced that name, the crowd just lose their mind and for the shock and awe value of it. I think that definitely would work in today's time.
I remember when they inducted Gordon Solie without his knowledge of it, the surprise of being inducted really caught Gordon Solie off guard. You could tell he was not prepared for that. So I think, you know, a surprise induction or two in the Hall of Fame with people that are there, absolutely, like you said, would work at a really great reaction. You'd get a lot more emotion out of the Hall of Fame probably, where guys aren't just spending weeks perfecting a Hall of Fame speech. They'd be on the fly just saying how they felt at the time, and it'd be great. That's a lot of what the WCW Hall of Fame seemed to be. Well, guys, we're just about out of time. So, QT, any last thoughts on World Championship Wrestling?
Well, Sangai, I hope that someday Turnbuckle Turmoil can approach the WCW Hall of Fame and its notoriety. Yes. And I'd like to tell Dimitri if he has any suggestions on who should go into the Turnbuckle Turmoil Hall of Fame for this coming year to submit his choices.
I will start ahead in doing that.
Very good. Okay. Yes.
All right. D, any last thoughts on WCW?
I'm just saying that for some of the younger fans out there, wrestling fans, they're 25 and under, take a moment, look it up, type it up, WCW. Look up some of your favorite names. Look up names like Rey Mysterio, Scott Hall. Look up, like, say, even Crowbar and see the time difference of what they were back then, or even like Jericho, when you can see Jericho back then, or someone like Lance Storm who came in during that time, took pretty much every title but the heavyweight title. And, I mean, look up those matches, see the names of your wrestler that you like of today in the matches, see, or look up something new. Check out what the Cruiserweight division was when I heard y'all talk about that. Take a chance to look back at the history and see why a lot of fans were fans and why Monday nights were so special back then. And support
independent
wrestling.
Absolutely. So anyone that has the WWE Network has access to a lot of WCW material. All of the Nitros are on there. The Clash of Champions are on there. We didn't even mention the Clash of Champions. It was a quarterly event. They'd have four per year free on TBS. They'd have them during the week, like on a Wednesday or a Thursday, usually 2 hours to 2.5 hours of main event level matches, which back then was rare because you usually got several squash matches, and then the main event would be two push ties, Clash of Champions. Everybody that was main event level was facing off against each other. It was great. All of those available on the network. So many names. We could stay here another hour and just rattle off all of the top names that was connected to WCW. Guys like Dustin Rhodes, guys like Ric Flair, guys like Chris Jericho, like was said, like Kevin Sullivan, like Crowbar, like even James Storm and Chris Harris got their start in WCW as the Bischoff and Russo security guards. AJ Styles had a brief run in WCW, cut short when the WWE bought it. So many guys have ties to WCW. Even John Cena was in the WCW-produced movie Ready to Rumble. So even John Cena has a small connection to WCW. Get on there, research it. One of the most successful promotions for part of his existence. Check it out. See why it was so successful. We'll be back with you next week. Next Friday afternoon, we have the return of Dash Venture, who has not been on here in quite some time. And then next Sunday, we are paying tribute once again. Next week, the tribute to the National Wrestling Alliance. We'll have some people that have been affiliated with the NWA, both past and present. Check it out. Should be an outstanding time. And we'll talk to you next week.